storytelling and poetry in the 1990s, the state of the art and what's on the horizon, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with the writers Alan Gerganus and Robert Ginger. Later, you'll hear from two poets, Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller. Support for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Along with its companion, the novel, short fiction in America rises and falls in critical and popular estimate. But what do the storytellers themselves have to say about the outlook for short fiction? Alan Gerganus is the author of a collection of stories and novellas, White People, which recently appeared in paperback from Ivy Books and won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Fiction. He's also the author of a novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. Robert Ginger is a writer, teacher, and critic. His collection of short stories by North Carolina writers, The Rough Road Home, will be published in November by the University of North Carolina Press. With one writer's reflections about contemporary short fiction in North America, here's Alan Gerganus.
Well, people always ask where the subject matter comes from, and anybody with 35 cents to buy a newspaper has enough to write about for a lifetime. I think you tell the story that you know must be told next, and you also feel the company of other people who are telling stories. I mean, I live part-time in New York and part-time in North Carolina, and there's an enormous difference between the relationship of writers in my New York community and in my North Carolina community.
Well, what do you have in mind?
I think in North Carolina there's a kind of joy in other writers' successes and other writers' material, and there's a way in which we read each other with an eye to encouraging each other. And it's a very different notion than the slightly corporate notion that, for example, if literature were the junior trainee program at General Motors, and you weigh in with 60 hot shots just out of school, and the first lecturer says, one of you will be the chairman of the board in 25 years.
Oh, nice.
And your object is to knock out as many of the other people sitting on your left and right as possible. And if this means playing great handball, then by God, you do that. You do whatever it takes. And it's a very different notion than the notion of literature, which is we're all telling separate stories that wind up especially easy to see in North Carolina as a single story.
Bob Ginger, is Alan talking about the consumer ethic in this country, or is he talking, the pressure of competition, or is he really talking about the short story as a literary form?
Well, what interests me, I'm not trying to evade that question, but what interests me more is the idea that there is a single story, and I've heard Alan say that before to audiences, and it's something that seems very true to me in reading stories. And in looking at narrative, getting an idea of how one story really doesn't make any sense at all in itself, but only in a larger context, in the total order of words or of stories, does one story really make sense.
What about the adjective that we're going to apply here, the North Carolina short story? Is there something peculiar at work in our region that produces such a great number of fine writers, particularly short story writers?
Well, I don't know. I think you could make it. There has been a kind of industry made of that thesis, but I don't know. It's maybe that I'm not that interested in whether that's true or not. I think there's something about Southern manners for sure.
Uh-huh.
I was talking to a friend and his wife from he's a Harvard educated doctor recently, and I was asking him about Northern manners. I said, "Tell me something about Northern manners," and he said, "There aren't any." and his wife said, "Did you say Northern manners? You know, what are they?" So, but we're not just talking about etiquette. We're just talking about custom, the familiar. And Alan can have a story, for example, his condolences for every one of us, in which a woman goes on a travel tour. Here's a woman in Africa, in Tongaville. And really, she draws her strength, all of her strength from, as it turns out in this story, Toledo, Ohio. And what I think what Alan does and what a lot of writers are doing now is making what I'd call a church of the particular. She draws strength from thinking about a maple spice rack back home when she's confronted with these raging natives who are killing people right and left around her. And that becomes, that icon becomes almost churchly. It becomes like an altar, Alan says later in the story. So he's made a church of the particular.
Well, now here he's writing about a woman who's reflecting on something in Ohio. Alan, is this a Southern phenomenon that you have, transported northward in this story?
Well, I have several theories about how it came to happen that we're Southern talking. We're born talking. I think climate has more, you know, all our geography teachers in fifth grade told us climate is everything. And before air conditioning, which I think may be as important a BCAD demarcation as television, people sat on porches. Nothing got done in the South in the summer. People sat around and drank gallons of iced tea. And the one thing you could move with least effort is your jawbone. And so people wagged that jawbone, and it developed into a high art form. The connection between talking and writing is indelible. And if you know how to talk, and if you've got a pen in your hand, you've got an enormous head start.
Has this happened to you, Alan? I won't say has it happened. I will say how and with what effects.
That's right. Well, I think we all grow up and in North Carolina, and especially in small town North Carolina. And those of us with any imagination want to get the hell out of Dodge as soon as possible. And then if we're lucky and ambitious, we do. And then from some distant perspective, we discover that what we really care about by reading our own work is the place where we started. And if we're lucky, we find a way of coming back on our own terms. I mean, one of the reasons that Rocky Mount was difficult for me was because I was always my father's son, and I was always my grandfather's grandson, and my great-grandfather's great-grandson. And I couldn't go anywhere in Rocky Mount without somebody saying, you're setting off firecrackers, and I'm going to call your four major relatives in 15 seconds. You know, I didn't have any freedom. I was not capable of anonymity. Mm-hmm. It's only in relation to anonymity that you understand what an identity is.
Is freedom one of the things that we have common? Is that a thread that runs through this book, either insofar as you, Bob Ginger, as an editor, have observed it in the people who are practicing the short story, or in what happens to the characters in these stories? Tell me about that.
Well, I'm thinking back to what Alan just said about anonymity and the quest to be, the ambition, where it will take you. I'm thinking of a story by Lee Smith, a fabulous story called The Bubba Stories, in which Charlene Christian, who comes from a peanut farm in South Hill, Virginia, thinks there could be anything worse. I don't want to be a writer, and I picture myself as this emaciated, hollow-cheeked woman with a black shawl on, looking at the south of France and thinking about which lover loves me the most. That's my idea. That's what I'm trying to arrive at. And she begins to find that her creative writing class short stories are disastrous. Nobody likes them. She's not writing about anything but this heroine she's dreamed up. But then she invents a lie about Bubba, a brother she has, which she doesn't have, to become popular at this Virginia girls' school. That's her greatest story. That's it. And that came right from her own backyard. Fred Chappell's Broken Blossoms, same thing. Same thing happening, where this boy is collecting stamps from Mauritania. Something is going to come from the outside and make him famous. It happens to be right in his own backyard. And it takes a whole story to get there, but then he sees in a new kind of way, as Charlene does.
Let me ask you to reflect on this, Bob Ginger, Alan Gerganis. What is your responsibility? Do you think you have a particular responsibility to yourselves, to your audiences, to your fiction, as an anthologizer, as a writer? Will you reflect on that for me briefly, Bob?
Well, getting an idea of, as a sample of what's out there and the enormous latitude of writing that's out there, but how stories are really, as we said earlier, I think, part of one single story in a way. And you begin to see that you read fiction, you begin to see in a story, well, didn't I read that before? Yeah, I did. But there were different characters, but the same truth is there, and it's happening again. It's a wonderful, it's kind of hard to talk about without particulars here, and maybe Alan can think about particular stories that do this, but I think the experience in a writing class of reading stories and saying, you know, my goodness, we just read that, but now I really understand it. Or reading a story again a second time after having read an accumulation of stories that deal with this trip out and back again is a real informative thing. And I would think that a good story does that. And I hope a decent anthology has stories that reflect this common theme.
Alan?
My first responsibility, I think, Wayne, is to the characters I'm writing about. to my language, to my community, and to some vision of the truth. Also, I have a responsibility to be entertaining and engaging, and I have a responsibility to, in writing about how much people mean to each other, how much people owe each other, to write about the world of ethics. And it seems to me that we're in a desperate time, a time of enormous unhappiness and an enormous period of disbelief in the possibility of leadership. And I would also sort of say that I feel an extra responsibility, a sense that to have a readership is to have a leadership. If you have readers who rely on your vision and your comedy and your sense of humanity, you have by nature students, people who are waiting to see what you have to say about the present. And if you're writing about Indian captivities in the 15th century, you are still writing about the present. That this is the business of transforming experience into a kind of crucible which is applicable, not only in terms of entertainment and delight, but in terms of those large questions about how much we owe each other.
Alan Gerganus, Bob Ginger, I owe you a lot for your willingness to come by the National Humanities Center. Bob, your new collection is The Rough Road Home, short stories by North Carolina writers, UNC Press. Alan Gerganus, your latest work out in paperback, White People, a collection of short stories. Fellas, thanks so much for coming by the center. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Poets and Poetry in the 1990s, The State of the Art and What's on the Horizon. Join me now for a conversation with Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller. Lee Young Lee is the author of two collections of poetry. His awards include the Lamont Poetry Selection of the Academy of American Poets and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Jim Wayne Miller is a poet, essayist, and professor of German at Western Kentucky University. His novel, Newfound, was named an American Library Association Best Book of the Year. I asked Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller to reflect on one of the poet's modern challenges, locating a personal voice in the interplay between mass culture and individual artistic identity. Lee Young Lee.
Well, I do think that poetry expresses our absolute singularity. But if we talk in terms of larger cultures, I think that there are currents in cultures that are singular, you know, to each culture. Mm-hmm. And I think literature or poetry asserts that singularity.
What about the fact that poetry has a reputation? You can help me with this, Jim Wayne Miller, Lee Young Lee. Poetry has a reputation of being subversive, that poets are critical of the societies that they live in. And we're talking here about poetry as a kind of a unifying force. Again, we have a paradox. Lee, what about that?
Well, I would say there is something perhaps dangerous about poetry in that it discovers the wilderness in the human being. Uh-huh. It discovers being, and it discovers passion, feeling. And I think that sometimes deep feeling is not necessarily coincident with being a good citizen or whatever.
Yeah, we don't want to mix civics with poetics necessarily.
But it's true that tyrants have historically been suspicious of poets. Mm-hmm. And tyrannical...
With good reason.
Yes, and tyrannical regimes, because yeah, tyrants have their own agenda. And poets very frequently suggest, as individuals, and they suggest to groups that they belong to, that there are other agendas, realities.
Fair enough. Lee Young Lee, talk to me about the question of identity and culture. You are, as I understand it, Malaysian by birth, Chinese by descent, American, having been reared in this country.
Yeah.
Have I got this right?
Well, yeah, my parents are Chinese. I'm Chinese, but I was born in Indonesia.
And we got a lot of what? Again, are these contradictory strands? What? I look at you wide-eyed and I say, what are you? culturally? How do you?
Funny, because I've asked myself, what am I? And I've had to, I think it's occurred to me often enough, the question, how do I exist? I've come to the conclusion that I'm lucky because I exist in the language, if I can say that. Poetry is a way for me to dwell inside the American English language.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me challenge you on this a little bit. At one level, that sounds terrific. At another level, you know, somebody out there who may not be a fan of poetry will listen to this broadcast and say, oh, here we go again. You know, more of this sort of blue skies hokum about finding oneself in poetry. Jim, would you reflect on that for me? And then, Lee, I'll come back to you.
Oh, I think it can happen not only for the writer, but for the reader of poetry. And I can cite specific examples of this heightened sense of language that have come to writers, especially in the 20th century, who have been in exile.
Uh-huh.
I mean, think of where Joyce wrote about Dublin. He wrote about it in France and Switzerland.
Indeed.
And we have Borges, you see. We have, I've mentioned Joyce, we have Nabokov,
mm-hmm.
He was an exile. He lived in Germany, he lived in France, he lived in this country. And sometimes when people go to another country and another culture and they're surrounded by a different language, this results in a heightened sense of the language they bring with them.
Indeed.
And they are at home in the language, which is the only place they can be at home in it.
Lee, do you have to be a political dissident, therefore, find yourself as a poet?
No, not at all. And I'd like to say something, if I may, about the idea about blue skies. And I think when a poet locates his or her being, mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily a very pleasant activity. For myself, I know, I can't speak for all poets, but for myself, it's been a pretty terrifying experience. For instance, my own being, I discovered, was attached to a greater reality, a greater impersonal, eternal, anonymous being.
What are you talking about? History? Politics? Economics?
I don't know. What is it? God? Mm-hmm. Timelessness? Whatever. And it wasn't a very happy experience. It was a pretty terrifying experience to think of myself as that there's a part of me that I'm inhabited by an impersonal, nameless, anonymous center. That's pretty terrifying.
And another way that I could, if I may, allow me to be politely disrespectful here, you could be talking the language of therapy here. We could be into the language of the self-help books. Hey, you know, poetry's going to get me in touch with myself. Now, there is some truth to that. On the other hand, there is a lot of what passes for poetry, which is not the genuine article. Jim, tell me about this.
Well, certainly. But I think that this is not a genteel enterprise that he's talking about. I think it has something to do more with the experience that people who have had genuine religious experiences throughout history,
mm-hmm.
confrontation with the numinous, for instance, as William James might refer to it, or as the German scholar Otto might refer to it. It is something that is other, and the result is you have a feeling, a creature feeling. You are just a poor, humble creature before this very powerful thing, very much like what Job experiences, mm-hmm. in the Old Testament.
Well, let me push the biblical mm-hmm. language here and turn to Lee Young Lee. Were you on the road to Damascus, and all of a sudden, bam, poetry hit you in the head, and you discovered that you had this burden or this obligation or this pressure, this weight on you? Why don't the rest of us experience this kind of thing? Why does it happen just to poets?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think everything in this culture pulls us away from that center. And I think art locates that center. All art, great uh-huh. art, you know, painting, music, it locates that center. I think it comes out of that center. And so every time we hear it, the center is located for us. But I think this culture pulls us away from that center.
Let me ask you to read me a poem, and we'll judge for ourselves. Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller.
Here's a poem called A Story. Sad is the man who is asked for a story and can't come up with one. His 5-year-old son waits in his lap. Not the same story, Baba, a new one. The man rubs his chin, scratches his ear. In a room full of books, in a world of stories, he can recall not one. And soon, he thinks, the boy will give up on his father. Already the man lives far ahead. He sees the day this boy will go. Don't go. Hear the alligator story, the angel story, once more. You love the spider story. You laugh at the spider. Let me tell it. But the boy is packing his shirts. He is looking for his keys. Are you a god, the man screams, that I sit mute before you? Am I a god that I should never disappoint? But the boy is here. Please, Baba, a story. It is an emotional rather than logical equation, an earthly rather than heavenly one, which posits that a boy's supplications and a father's love add up to silence. It was just telling my boy a story every night and noticing that I had less and less stories to tell, and the less, it was a very strange feeling. The fewer stories I had to tell, the thinner I felt. I mean, literally. I mean, in my body, I felt I was getting thinner and thinner.
Taking it out of you and putting it into him.
I really felt I was running out of something. And I began to realize that the idea of story is very, very, it's very old, and it's very substantial. It has to do, you know.
Sure. Jim Wayne Miller?
I believe we are story-consuming creatures, we human beings. I think we have to have almost our daily minimum requirement of story, of narrative in some sort. And one of the things that's happened in the last 100, 150 years is that we have, technology has provided us with so many more sources for our narrative, so that sometimes we think, is poetry declining? Well, that may be because people are able to buy VCRs or the newspapers. The ballad used to report great disasters and great events, and they were newspapers in a way. They serve that function. They no longer serve that function for us because we can more efficiently move that kind of material. Today, all over this country, I mean, people may be sitting, raptly listening to the results of a Senate hearing. That's a story.
It certainly is. Let's turn to another form of story. Jim Wayne Miller, I'd like to hear one of your poems, please.
This is a little poem called Light Leaving, and I talk about myself in the third person here. His mother was 16 when he was born. They grew up together. Now he's older than she is. But one thing never changes. Night always falls, drifting over fields, settling softly on the tops of trees, like his mother's black hair falling over her neck and down her back when she loosened her combs in the evening.
Why is poetry important? I mean, here we have, as Jim Wayne Miller has said, we live in a society of high technology and a lot of people would say low content. We're laden with message, at least with messenger, if not with message. Where does poetry find a home in a society like that, Jim?
Well, I think there's no danger in the function of poetry being supplanted by something else. We are simply constituted as human beings in such a way that those things that we see every day, day in and day out, we become habituated to. And not only poetry, but the other arts as well, I think, are about perception, finally. They're about seeing into, seeing the connections between things. And the arts help us to see a world that otherwise is just going to become dusted over by a fine film of the familiar. We stop seeing it unless the arts somehow help us to see it as if on the first day of creation.
We have a lot of talk in this country today about what is it that really forms our common core, our cultural, centralness. Do poets have anything to do with that? Is that really a problem for people in education rather than poets, Jim?
Poets deal with human feelings. They deal with familiar landscapes, with things that touch people in their emotions as well as in their minds. And to that extent, poets are often cultural brokers, or they may well be, they may be some sort of cultural spokesperson.
Mm-hmm. Lee Young Lee?
Yeah, I really love that answer, Jim. God, I love everything you've said. I guess art gives us an image of ourselves that's morally and ethically powerful and deep.
Jim Wayne Miller, you are a professor at Western Kentucky University. Lee Young Lee, you are teaching at the University of Oregon. I appreciate your appearance here on Soundings. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about storytelling and poetry in the 1990s. My guests were the writers Alan Gerganus and Robert Ginger, and the poets Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 616. That's program number 616, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Mental Worlds and Royal Politics. Linda Levy Peck of the University of Rochester and Annabel Patterson of Duke University will discuss the mental world of the Jacobean court in 17th century England. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Storytellers and poets, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. From the short story in the contemporary South to poetry worldwide in the 1990s, listen for two writers, Alan Gerganus and Robert Ginger, and two poets, Lee Young Lee and Jim Wayne Miller. Storytellers and poets, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.